Speaking of drinks, this one of the fall's favorite flavored drinks makes its appearance this time of year in coffee shops all around the world. Pumpkin spice latte. You might see the sign out front there talking about pumpkin spice lattes or pumpkin spice sermons. So I have to kind of add that into my sermon kind of a thing. But whether it's Starbucks or Dunkin' or your homemade brew, that's the it drink for this time of year. At least that's what many people think. Pumpkin spice lattes. Like many holiday staples, it comes out earlier and earlier every year. I remember hearing advertisements of them clear back in August of this year, end of August. Pumpkin spice lattes. Ooh. I'm not one of those people who enjoy pumpkin spice lattes. I'm not a big pumpkin spice type of person. But this is the drink that many people crave. They can't wait till it comes out every fall, and they drink it up all the way till November, December, when they change it over to the mint chocolate or whatever they have for December, so the mint peppermint drinks. But so some of it need it. They crave it. They can't live without it. Others like me really don't care for the taste and could easily do without it. It's kind of that either-or kind of drink, I think, that many of us either love it or hate it. I don't think there's an in-between. You might be able to come up to me after a service and say, oh, I'm an in-between. I'll drink it if it's there. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's one of those either-or type of drinks. Either you love it or you can't do it without it. Or maybe for you it's another type of drink that's flavored. Maybe it's a Mountain Dew or a coffee that's your it drink. That you cannot go without a day without having a big cup of coffee. You crave it. It's like you can't live without it. And all these are fun flavors to drink. Coffee and tea and pumpkin spice lattes are fun drinks. But there's some drinks you literally cannot live without. I mean, you can probably live without your pumpkin spice lattes. You do for 9 months of the year, six months of the year, anyways. But there's some drinks that we cannot live without, and that's water, right? I mean, we've all heard the things that our bodies are 60 to 70% water, and that we can only live for about 3 days without it, and without water, without something nourishing in us. Sam. Sam, please. Sorry. Anyways, there's water. We can't live without it. We cannot go more than 3 days without water or we'll die. But for the last 5 weeks, we've been looking at the wilderness wanderings of Israel. We've been talking about the way through the wilderness. How God was leading them through the wilderness to a land that he had promised to their forefathers, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And he started out by calling leaders like the nameless midwives who saved hundreds of babies from being killed. We read about Moses' parents and even Moses himself who God raised up and became leaders there. God gave the children of Israel the promise that he would deliver them from the land of Pharaoh and from the Egyptians. And with the plagues, he provided opportunities both for the Egyptians and for the Israelites to learn more about who God was and that he was going to fulfill his promise of deliverance. Then he opened the door for the Israelites to leave Egypt when he sent his final plague, the death angel that came, that killed every firstborn son, and that died in that land that one night, unless you had put the blood on the doorpost on your house. And then last week we saw how God parted the waters of the Red Sea so that the children of Israel could walk out of Egypt on dry ground. And in the midst of looking at these stories, we learned lessons and principles that we can apply to our lives. Our lives today, especially during those times in our lives when we seem to be wandering in a wilderness, in a desert of sorts. Those times in our lives when God seems distant and far away and our prayers just don't seem to be heard or go unanswered. When we feel abandoned or alone. Times when we are going through hardships or struggles or times of uncertainty. And God doesn't seem to care. And once again, we're going to see that even in those times in our deserts, if we take our eyes off, even for a moment, off of ourselves and our difficulties, we'll see how God continues to supply our needs. We may be still be going through the pain and strife, and our desire might be to get through that pain and strife, to come to an end. But if we look and are focused not on ourselves but on God, we'll see that God will bring us to the promised land, and even in the middle of our wilderness wanderings, God still supplies needs. So we're going to look at this morning a couple things there this morning. First of all, we're going to see how God supplies our needs through healing waters. The children of Israel were now out of Egypt. They had crossed the Red Sea, wherever that was on the map that we talked about last week. They did a little bit of singing and dancing to celebrate their freedom from annihilation and from the Egyptian army who was trying to come and attack them. And the Egyptian army drowned, trying to cross the same Red Sea that the Israelites had just walked through on dry ground. It was a wonderful time of celebration, and I wish I had time to explore it more last week. But you can look back on your own on the Song of Moses, or Song of Miriam, or Song of Freedom. There in chapter 15, it's full of trusting in God as a warrior. God was seen as a God who fights for them, who conquers. You can read that at the end of chapter 15. But then we come to how God meets them as they're on the trips to Mount Sinai. And this we read at the end of chapter 15 here. It says, "Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter." That's why the place is called Marah. It's Hebrew for bitter. "So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, 'What are we to drink?' Now remember how I said in the introduction that we can only last about 3 days without water? Well, I'm sure that they had brought some water from them from the Red Sea. I'm sure they filled up their canteens or whatever they had to truck the water in the desert. But water for 2 million people was quickly running short. And temperatures in that area of the world are usually around the 80s or in the highs and in the low 70s at night. So it's not too hot so far. But summer was coming when temperatures would definitely spike there in the wilderness. And so God leads them out into the desert. And they had to find water. Now just to make a quick side note here. We talked last week about the pillar of cloud that guided them by day. And the pillar of fire that guided them by night. And I'm sure that made a little bit of difference as far as the heat goes. As far as keeping them cool in the day and warm at night. But I came something that across in a commentary this week that I really not applied or thought too much about concerning the cloud. Because we read throughout the wilderness wanderings here that there are certain places along the trip that God led them to in order to get to the promised land. That the people stopped where God stopped and went where God told them to go. And I never thought about it that God led them to certain places and provided no water for them. He led them to a place where there was bitter waters. I mean, he could have just, we'll read later on in 15 there, that there's a place called Elam. And he could have led them right to Elam. And said, "Hey, you can camp here. This has all these 70 palm trees and camp near here to water." But he led them to this place of Marah, bitter waters. Why did God lead them to a place there? Well, I think, as we'll learn today, that he wants to teach them certain things on their trip to Mount Sinai. I mean, God had shown himself as a mighty, powerful God in the Exodus time, when he showed his plagues and showed the waters parting, and he showed himself as a mighty warrior, as they sang about, as I just said. But now they needed to know God in a different way. They needed to know God in a way that he had not revealed himself before. I mean, they had been slaves for hundreds of years in Egypt and did not know really who God was, other than maybe stories from long ago. But they needed to see for their own selves that God was there to test them, to show them, to teach them lessons. And when I say the word testing, I don't mean he's grading them on a test type of thing like you have in school. He's just saying, "Hey, let me show you some things I want you to learn. Here's some things I want you to take down, to take note of. Now, I was a mighty warrior in Egypt. Now I'm going to be the God who supplies. I'm going to be the God who provides. I'm going to be the God who heals," as we'll see here in a minute. So when the Bible says to test them, it's not the kind of test that we need to know the right answers to. God is just showing himself more about himself in this passage. And I think this is vital to understanding this passage, because God is still, the Israelites are still learning who God is. They've already seen his power. They've seen his ability to fight. And now he's going to show them another aspect of his character. In fact, in a minute, he's going to give them another name by which they will know him more fully. But let's get back to the story here. I've kind of got on the side note here, but let's get back to the story. God leads them to this place of bitter waters. And the people start to grumble. Now we'll see this, that this is going to be a common characteristic of the Israelites in the desert, that they grumble in the desert. In fact, there are many places in the Bible that mention the grumbling that they did in the deserts. We see this in Psalm 75, 17 through 19. It says, "And they continued to sin against him, rebelling in the desert against the Most High. They willfully put the God to the test by demanding food they craved. They spoke against God, saying, 'Can God spread a table in the deserts?'" We see this in Psalm 106. "Then they despised the pleasant land. They did not believe his promise. They grumbled in their tents and did not obey the Lord." And even in the New Testament, Paul gives us an example of how we are not to follow in their examples. It says in 1 Corinthians 10, "We should not test the Lord, as some of them did, and they were killed by snakes. And do not grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed or killed by the destroying angel." I mean, there's passage after passage about them grumbling in the wilderness. But I'm not sure if these passages that we're looking at this morning, if that's really the point that we should take from these passages this morning. Because, first of all, I think these are very reasonable requests here of God. I mean, they're not asking for anything too spectacular. They're asking for water to drink. I mean, they've been out in the desert for 3 days now. They come to this water that's bitter for them. They cannot drink it. And they're saying, "God, give us water to drink. We need something to sustain us." It's a need. It's not a want. It's not a desire. It's not something super spectacular. They need this. And so I think, first of all, that's a reasonable request, whether that be food or, as we'll see in a minute, or water, or in a minute we'll see food. But next, I don't see God in these passages saying really anything against them and saying, "Hey, stop complaining. You know, you shouldn't complain like this," or God saying anything like that. God is not critical at this point and responds critically. In fact, in these first three cases where the people complain, they're just coming out of Egypt, and God doesn't say anything negative about their response, their request. The only place where God responds with a bit of harshness is in that second story where God provides manna for them, that we'll look at in a minute. And when the people of Israel went out on the seventh day to collect manna, God kind of was upset at them. It says, "How long are you going to refuse my commands and my instructions?" And that's it. Are you going to? That's the greatest condemnation that God gives to these people. So I think these first three complaints that we're looking at this morning are not the type of grumbling and complaining that to God that we should focus on. Maybe later on, after they get to Mount Sinai, they leave Mount Sinai and continue on, when they start complaining there in Numbers chapters 11, 12, 14, 17, when they complain, then God sends punishments upon them. Then God condemns them and says, "Hey, you know, you're complaining against me, and I can provide for you." I mean, this is after he's provided for them for many years. After Mount Sinai, and they're still complaining. That's when God starts to get upset at them, starts saying, "Hey, I'm going to punish you if you keep complaining." It is only later on that when God has taken care of them for several years, that God gets angry with their questioning and grumbling and complaining. But here, I don't see that. So I'm not going to focus on complaining or grumbling this morning, as much as I'm sure most of you would like to hear about. I'm not just about complaining or grumbling. I don't think that's applicable here. But again, I need to stop. And get back to the story, because the story goes that Moses is here. They come to this water that's bitter, Mirah, and God shows them a stick. It says God shows them a stick, and he throws it into the water, and it heals the waters. The waters become sweet. We don't know why the waters were bitter. We don't know how they were bitter. We don't know we don't know how special the stick was, whether it was just a normal stick or some kind of special wood of some kind. We don't know anything about that. It's pointless to speculate on either of those two things, because we really don't know. Because God could have done it in any number of ways, right? He could have changed that water just like it did this morning by magically putting a cloth over it, or he could have done it by Moses striking the water with his stick, or Moses pulling out a staff like he did with the Nile. That's how God performed it in the past, or maybe throwing a rock or a leaf or a banana in the water could have cured this water. God could have asked them to build an altar or worship him and offer sacrifices, or Moses could have done a rain dance. Or there's all kinds of things of ways God could have changed that water from being bitter to being sweet. It kind of, again, it's pointless to speculate. Kind of interesting though, modern day technology now is able to make swampy, dirty water clean and drinkable. I mean, it's a little chemical I saw. You can see it online there. If you look for it, P&G has come out with a powder, a little packet of powder that you can put into a 5-gallon pail of dirty, swampy, mucky water, and you stir it up, and I wish I had the video. I tried to get the video to play for you to kind of show you the demonstration here, but I couldn't get the video actually to download for me. But you stir it up, and you wait for 20, 30 minutes, and you can see the dirt start to coalesce and to, what's the word I put down here? Congeal, and it sinks to the bottom, and then the water on top is purified. Again, these special chemicals or whatever it is, purified. It's not bleached or anything, but it's purified. It's clear. You can see it crystal clear, and you can actually drink it. And actually, the video that I saw, the person that came up with this showed it to Bill Gates, the famous billionaire. And Bill Gates was very interested in this and says, hey, this is something we can send over to Africa and something that I can support with my finances. And actually, from what I understand, he supports this type of thing that they can send it over to Africa and it purifies water. I mean, the special chemical, whatever it is, purifies water. But again, how God purified the water, he knew about this chemical formula clear back then. He could have. But he did it. The method or the object did not really matter, because what mattered, what we need to take from this, is that they could trust God to provide for them. Trust God to supply their need. And their need, their most wanted need, their most pressing need in the desert was water. And so he healed the water, turning it from undrinkable to drinkable. This is what it says there in verse 26 of chapter 25. It says, if you listen carefully to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep his decrees, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases that I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. See, God is saying, I'm teaching you that if you choose to follow me, if you choose to live your life in line with what I asked you to do, I'm going to bring you healing. I'm going to not destroy you, for I am a God who doesn't just destroy. I'm not a warrior God. I'm also a healing God. I am the God who heals. Jehovah Rapha is the Hebrew word. And I love those Hebrew words there. It talks about how God is revealing this new aspect. I like what one of my study Bibles says about this. It says, they needed not only to observe the mighty works of his power, but also to depend upon him in a practical way for the very necessities of life. See, God, yes, he's a powerful, mighty God, that parted the waters, that killed the Egyptians, and yet he's also a God who is concerned about our practical lives, for our day-to-day lives, as we'll see in a moment. He's no longer just Yahweh. He is Yahweh Rophi, the God who heals. And this name is not just a name that refers to God who makes bitter waters drinkable. He's a God who heals from all sicknesses. Healing from diseases. All our diseases. It says in Exodus 23:25, worship the Lord your God, and his blessing will be upon your food and water, and I will take away sickness from among you. He heals us from our diseases. But he also heals us from our sins as well. Psalm 103 talks about this. He says, praise the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your sins and heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pits and crowns you with love and compassion. You see, it's great to worship God who's so mighty and powerful, but also God who's concerned and loves and has compassion upon us. And of course, Psalm 147 talks about how he even heals broken hearts. He heals up the brokenhearted and binds up their wounds. You see, God is concerned about all of our aspects of healing, not just physical, but our mental, our hearts, our sinfulness. Jesus came for these same reasons. In fact, Jesus, it says in Matthew, says, Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching the synagogues and preaching the good news of the kingdom. And what? Healing every disease and sickness from among the people. That's one of Jesus' things. In fact, it talks about later on how did I put this on? Nope, I didn't. How John's disciples come to Jesus and say, are you the Messiah? And Jesus says, well, look around you. What have I been doing? I've been healing the sick. I've been giving sight to the blind. I've been, the lame now walk, the leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised from life, and the good news is preached to the poor. This is Jesus' task. This is what Jesus does, and why Jesus came to heal us. And you know what? I think we can apply this to our lives as well. Because God didn't just come to the Israelites just out of Egypt and says, hey, I'm going to heal these waters for you. He comes to us even today and says, hey, I want to supply your needs by healing the waters that you are going through. Healing the waters that you need to sustain your life. Healing those broken hearts. Healing those lives that have been damaged from sin. I've come to give you life, Jesus says. I've come to supply your needs and supply them with healing. One of the prophecies about Jesus in Isaiah is the prophecy about bringing healing in his wings. It's a wonderful picture of how God comes to heal us. God's there to heal you today. He knows what your needs are. He knows what your concerns are. And he is a God who heals. Again, love that picture. The one place in the Bible where it talks about the God who heals and how God healed not only just the waters, but heals them as well. Let me go on to my second point here. You see, God not only supplies our needs through healing waters or by his healings, but he also supplies our needs daily. The 16th chapter of the story about is how God provides manna in the wilderness. And I don't have much time to read through the whole story here, but I would encourage you to do so here this next week. How God provides manna in the wilderness. Again, the Israelites grumble. They grumble saying this, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into the desert to starve this entire assembly to death. Again, it sounds like complaining, but I'm going to give them a little bit of benefit of the doubt. Because again, God doesn't really focus on their grumbling. He says, hey, I'm going to supply your needs. And he does so. He provides manna for them. He provides even quail for them at night in this story. We're not sure, again, in the passage in Numbers 2, he also provides quail for them in abundance when they complain. And so we're not sure how the quail, if it was a temporary time at this time, or if it was kind of like manna every night. We just don't read about that. We read how he provided manna every day, but we don't read about how he provided quail every night. But that's in the story here too, how he provides even quail and meat for them during the night. But again, that's kind of getting off of topic here, because again, the focus is not on their grumbling, or not necessarily upon the food itself. Again, it's God showing them that, hey, I can provide food for you. I'm here to supply your needs. And so God sends manna. And again, we don't know what it was. They didn't know what it was. But it was easy to pick up and it filled their bellies. But God puts two restrictions upon this gift of manna. Two things he said, hey, I want you to do this just to teach you to follow me, to know that I am supplying your needs and supplying them daily. He says, first of all, you can only eat and collect the right amount of the food for that one day. They would go out in the morning, collect the food, eat it for that day. But it tells us, not just once, but twice, from God, a reminder from Moses in verse 19, that if you collected more than you could eat, then it would be filled with maggots and be stinky the next day. And that's what happened to some of them. They collected more than they ought to have. They didn't eat it, and the next day it was filled with maggots and it stunk. And so it says, you can only collect one day worth of food. Except for the second, or the sixth day. Because the second rule that God places over them, collecting manna, is in verse 5, and it's that you collect twice as much on the sixth day, so that way they can rest on the seventh day. Now, this is the first time in the Bible that we have talk about the Sabbath day. I mean, this is before they got to Mount Sinai, so that hasn't given them the law yet. There is a reference back in the beginning, in Genesis, that how God rested on the seventh day and made it holy, but that the book of Genesis probably hasn't been written yet. I mean, Moses hadn't written it, or whoever wrote the book of Genesis had not written it down yet. They might have heard stories from their oral teachings, from their grandfathers and great-grandfathers about how God rested on the seventh day, but they really didn't have this into practice anymore. They were slaves there in Egypt, and they worked 7 days a week, right? There's no mention of the Sabbath before this. So the children of Israel was introduced to this day of rest that God was going to provide for them. He says, hey, now, here in the wilderness, starting from now on, I'm going to give you 1 day a week where you can rest and worship me. 1 day a week where we can allow God to be part of our lives in a special way. Now imagine hearing that for the first time. I mean, we've grown up knowing this, that we should come to the Lord's house and worship on the Sabbath, or on Sunday in our case. But this was the first time they heard this. Hey, we get a day every week to worship God? We don't have to work, we don't have to do things in our normal daily lives anymore? God has now given an opportunity to rest and to worship. He is including an opportunity for them to take time out of the busy schedule to focus on Him, to spend time with Him, to dwell in His presence, and to allow their bodies to recover from their weekly task. I mean, they were, again, slaves in Egypt. They worked 7 days a week probably in Egypt. Hard labor. For as long as they can remember. But now God was saying, hey, just like I rested back in Genesis in creation, I'm going to give you a day of rest. In fact, not only are you going to rest, but I'm going to rest too. I'm going to provide for you on that Saturday, that Sabbath. And so he asked them, hey, pick up twice as much on Saturday, on Sunday, or on Friday night, or Friday morning, I guess. So that way on Saturday morning, you wouldn't have to go out on their Sabbath. That was their Sabbath on Saturday. That way you can rest, relax on that Saturday, that Sabbath day, and worship me. And while it was not able to be kept, this manna was not able to be kept overnight during the week, miraculously, for some reason, on this Friday night, it would be kept. And they would have food the next day on the Sabbath. It would keep overnight. It would not have the maggots or stink. It's quite amazing. I mean, I don't know if God made a different kind of manna on Friday night or Friday morning when they picked it up, or if it was the same manna and God just, okay, I'm going to keep away the maggots. I don't know how God can perform that miracle. But, again, that's kind of subsequent to what God was teaching them here. Because I think what's important, what God is teaching to them, is, hey, you need to trust me daily. You need to know that I can supply your needs, but I'm not going to give you more than you need, necessarily. I'm going to supply what you need. I'm going to give you the bread for this day and provide for their needs then. Because like many people, some of these people didn't follow God's instructions. They ended up with maggots in their manna and went hungry on Saturday because they didn't collect twice as much that they needed. But I will give them a little bit of grace, especially in the first week, because, again, this is all new to them. They're learning about how God provided for them on a daily basis. They had not experienced this kind of God before. They were still trying to understand who He was. They'd only seen His provision once with the bitter water before. However, I do want to point out, I do need to make it clear that both Moses and God get a bit upset over the people's unwillingness to listen. I mean, verses 20 and 28, Moses criticized them for collecting too much during those first weekly times, or daily times of the week. And then God, in verse 28, condemns them for going out on the Sabbath day to try to collect something and they don't find anything. So there's some criticism here, but they're lessons that they needed to learn. But the lesson that God truly wanted them to hold above all else was to trust Him daily. Not a time to rely upon themselves, not a time to collect a whole lot and then just relax the rest of the week. This was a test that they needed to trust God day by day. We sang that song this morning, right? Day by day. Every passing moment, we need to trust in Him. We need to look to Him. We need to find strength in Him. It's not I can trust Him on Sunday, and then, Monday to Friday, I can just forget Him and don't do nothing. And then Sunday again, I can trust Him. God didn't say, trust me weekly. He says, trust me daily. It's not enough just to trust God when you're struggling or when you've fallen or trust him only when you have good times and not the bad. We need to trust him just the same as on Monday as we do on Sunday. We too need to ask God every day for our daily bread. That's what Matthew 6:11 says. It says, give us this day our daily bread. It doesn't say, give us this day our weekly bread. I mean, that'd be nice, right, sometimes? Oh God, give us on Sunday all of our we need for the rest of the week. No. He says, hey, I want you to know about me on the Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays and all the days in between. Rely upon us. Trust in Jesus. Rely upon him. This is the lesson that God taught the children of Israel. It's something that we need to be taught again and again today, right? I love what George Morrison said about the Israelites there. He says, it took one night to take Israel out of Egypt, but 40 years to take Egypt out of the Israelites. One night he took them out of Egypt, but it took them 40 years to get this idea of rely upon themselves, rely upon their circumstances to get them through. I hope it doesn't take us that long to get the Egypt out of us, right? I hope we can trust God daily to work in our lives, daily to work in us. And we say, hey God, today I need you just as much as I needed you yesterday. I've eaten up all the things that you gave me yesterday. I need more. I need more of you, day by day. And finally, God supplies our needs through unexpected sources. Once again, the children of Israel find themselves without water. Once again, they grumble and quarrel. Now, this must have been sometime later because it appears that they're close to Mount Horeb, which is another mountain near Mount Sinai. Sometimes it's even synonymous in some ways with it. But this might have been a place where we saw last week, might have been where this rock is at in modern day Saudi Arabia. But God tells Moses, hey, I want you to stand there before the rock at Horeb, strike the rock, and water will come out of it for the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. Excuse me. Water comes out of a rock for them to drink. Now, unlike this miracle of the Mira, where he makes the bitter water sweet, here he brings water from nothing. I can't even do that. There might be a magic trick that I can bring water out of them, but I can't bring it out of the rock, literally, like God did. But again, God is showing these people, trust me. You know, I've gotten you through this all this time now. Again, like I said, they must be near Mount Sinai or close thereat, because Mount Horeb is close, as it says there, the rock at Horeb. It's close to Mount Sinai, wherever that might be, whether it be in the Sinai Peninsula or there in Saudi Arabia. But again, God's not concerned mainly about the grumbling, I don't think, at this point. He says, hey, I'm going to provide for you again. See, this is another opportunity to reinforce his provision for them. They needed another reminder that God was with them through it all. Reminds me of another hymn. Little chorus. I couldn't find it this morning, but through it all, I've learned to trust in Jesus. I've learned to trust in God. Through it all, I've learned to depend upon his word. Right? See, that's what God wants from us this morning. That through everything he brings us through the hard times, through the good times, through the struggles, through the joys, we need to learn to depend upon Jesus and God, the word that he brings to us. I hope that's our testimony, that we trust in him, that no matter what we have going on, what we're going through, that we can look to him, we can trust in him, that we can trust him, even from unexpected ways and unexpected sources. I mean, who knows? We might see God supply our needs in unexpected ways. I mean, there's countless testimonies down through the ages. George Mueller, how people supply the needs for him. Different missionaries that I've read about, how God, they're struggling with some financial times and God brings the right finances right along, or how God brings healing in sickness times. But he comes in unexpected ways that we don't understand, ways that we don't see. I remember that verse from last week that we looked at from Isaiah 43:19. It says, see, I'm doing a new thing. It springs up. Do you not perceive it? I'm making a way in the wilderness, or a way in the desert, streams in the wasteland. I'm doing a new thing. I'm not going to do it like I did before. I'm doing a new thing. In fact, it says in the chapter 4, verse 42, and I wish I, again, would have put this up on the screen, but I must have not done it this morning as I put the slides together. It says in verse 42, verse 9, it says, "See, the former things have taken place. New things I declare. Before they spring into being, I announce them to you." Now this chapter talks about how, especially the Messiah was going to come, and God's promise of the Messiah, and how he's going to bring a new thing. How we see that in Jesus, how he brings us the new thing for us. The prophecy about the Messiah to come and bring healing to the nations, how Jesus would come to supply our greatest need, which is our sins, right? To cleanse us from those sins. So God does things in unexpected ways. Don't say, "Okay, God, I want you to do this for me, but do it in this way." I mean, that just limits God so much. And God says, "Hey, guess what? I'm going to do something new. I'm going to do things that you might not expect. And we might not understand them right away," right? Just like the children of Israel didn't understand this. And yet they learned to depend upon God at this time. So what does God want you to learn this morning? What lesson in the wilderness is he teaching you about your needs? Because he can supply your needs by healing the waters around you. He supplies your needs daily. And he supplies your needs in unexpected ways as well. We need to trust in him. We need to look to him. Because sometimes we look to ourselves, we look to what we think we need. We look, "Hey God, I need this now." And God says, "Well, do you need this?" In these cases in the Bible here, they did. They need this food, they need this water. And maybe we say, "Hey God, as I look at myself, as I look at my needs, here's what I want you to do." That's not what God does. I love how Peter ends, says at the conclusion of his commentary on this passage. He says, "We must continually be on guard against our all too common percent for judging our circumstances by our stomachs," how the Israelites did. "That this is precisely what the Israelites in the wilderness deserts were guilty of. You must ask, why did they not trust God to help them? Especially after all they've seen already." You know, how many have thought of that, about these passages like this? Why did they trust God to help them? They've seen all his miracles, why didn't they trust him? The answer is not simply a lack of faith. That's too vague. Israel's error in the desert is a sin common to us all, and the one from which so many of our sins derive. It's self-centeredness. I like that. I like that. Too often we're so focused on us that we don't see how God's going to heal up the waters around us. We don't see how God's going to provide our daily needs. We don't see how God's going to provide in unexpected ways. We need to stop looking upon ourselves and look to God. The desert was very difficult for Israel. We're too often condemned to them. We too often condemn them. But think about it. Would we do much better? Probably not. How often do we fall short in our lives? How often do we need God to come and show us himself anew, to revive us and trust in him?